really is not much of a question about what the expectations are for folks drilling in the Arctic.
Interior officials defend their regulations for Arctic ocean drilling. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, narcotics officers say drug dealers are using unsuspecting rural Alaska travelers as drug mules.
I hear about this pretty frequently. People walking up to a boarding passenger saying, "Can you carry this to Dillingham for me? It's a birthday present or it's a pair of shoes."
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The U.S. Senate voted down a host of new gun regulations, including a new assault weapons ban. Senators bucked public opinion and voted against expanding background checks to online sales and gun shows. And it nixed a plan to limit the size of ammunition magazines. Alaska Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski voted against those three provisions. Immediately following the vote, a liberal group, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, blasted an email saying it will run ads opposing Senator Begich in his reelection campaign next year. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid canceled the vote on the overall bill, a maneuver that technically keeps it alive. But today's vote effectively killed any attempt to reform the nation's gun laws 124 days after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. At an Arctic Energy Summit in Washington, D.C., federal regulators pushed back against ConocoPhillips, citing regulatory uncertainty. ConocoPhillips recently announced it is suspending its Arctic drilling campaign indefinitely. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Deputy Secretary of the Interior David Hayes says the federal government has been explicit in its demands of companies planning to drill in the Arctic Ocean. He says every company will need a capping stack and containment system in case of a spill.
There really is not much of a question about what the expectations are for folks drilling in the Arctic. We've laid it out with Shell. We've told the rest of the industry these are the expectations. They're common sense expectations. Number two, we learned through last summer that it's hard to pull this off in the Arctic.
Secretary Hayes is referencing Shell's bungled summer. The company hoped to drill to oil-producing depths, but repeated errors and government punishments prevented that from happening. Instead, Shell drilled two pilot wells, then grounded its drilling rig Kulik on the way home to Seattle. The Department of Interior followed with a report laying out a guideline for all future Arctic drilling. Companies will now be required to oversee every aspect of the drilling operation, from marine transit to drilling to closing the well down for the season. At the Arctic Energy event, Secretary Hayes made clear to the international audience that the United States should lead in sensible standards on Arctic operators.
We are setting together a menu of expectations that can provide the blueprint for what other companies should do or what other countries should expect of their companies throughout the Arctic.
Also on the panel was Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell.
There are big prospects in the Arctic and small prospects in the Arctic.
Treadwell says he met with Conoco executives who say the federal government's rules are too unclear to decipher. He's advocating for a case-by-case set of regulations for each operator, not an Arctic-wide policy.
If two companies can't say, hey, we're going to go about this in a different way, you've got a problem.
Treadwell says he's worried undue federal regulations will force oil companies out of Alaska, leaving the Trans-Alaska pipeline in peril. To Treadwell, that's just one reason the recently passed tax cuts make the state more enticing. Treadwell says Governor Sean Parnell will soon sign the bill into law. That's welcome news to Secretary Hayes.
Well, that'll be great because that in the near term is the way to continue that pipeline.
And for the foreseeable future, the oil in the pipeline will come from land, not the ocean. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
State narcotics officials say unsuspecting travelers are being used as drug mules to carry illegal pills to rural Alaska. Earlier this month, authorities intercepted a package of oxycodone pills at the Anchorage airport. They were inside a bag a traveler agreed to take to Dillingham for another woman. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Imagine for a moment that you're sitting at the airport in Anchorage, waiting to board a flight home to Dillingham. Someone you know, or at least know of, shows up and asks if you'll do them a favor and carry a bag or gift or even a pet on the flight and drop it off to someone in Dillingham. That's a fairly common practice traveling both directions. Now imagine that after accepting that package, you look inside and discover a false bottom, and in that false bottom is a suspicious-looking vacuum-sealed bag, the contents of which you can only assume must be drugs. That's exactly what happened on April 4th, and the drugs inside the package were oxycodone tablets. Investigator Nazrik Ney of the Dillingham Want Office.
This particular package was purported to have snake food in it, and it had several packages of frozen baby mice in there. But a false bottom was discovered in the package, and in that false bottom was a packet of wrapped paper. Investigation led to the opening of that packet, and it was determined to contain several oxycodone tablets. And these tablets had been cut in half, indicating that they were for sale for $100 a piece rather than $200 for a whole tablet.
The 9 half tablets were seized. Under arrest is 34-year-old Mary Jean Burkhart, who was accused of taking the package to the airport in Anchorage. Burkhart asked a Dillingham resident getting ready to board the flight if he could take the box of frozen dead mice to 22-year-old Lindsay Sifsoff for a pet snake in Dillingham. At first unwitting, the man agreed and accepted the box. He then checked inside and discovered the suspicious contents and quickly notified the airport police. Used as a substitute for heroin, oxycodone tablets are considered by the state of Alaska as being among the most dangerous drugs on the street. At $100 per half tablet, the bag had an estimated street value of $900. Ney says that's borderline between what's considered an amount of drugs for personal use and an amount intended to be sold. Either way, he's glad to get any amount of oxycodone off the streets in Bristol Bay, where he sees it destroying families and literally killing users.
It's a ever-accelerating path towards family and physical destruction, is what I've seen.
There are other concerns being raised by this bust. As authorities have cracked down on smuggling through some traditional routes into rural communities, drug traffickers may be increasing their efforts to enlist unsuspecting travelers as drug mules.
In my work, I hear about this pretty frequently. People walking up to a boarding passenger saying, "Can you carry this to Dillingham for me? It's a birthday present or it's a pair of shoes or something like that." And then the package is picked up by another person on the other end. And we hear after the fact that the package actually contained some type of illegal drug. Nowadays, most of the time, it's oxycodone.
Drug traffickers are, at best, jeopardizing the reputation of the innocent people offering to carry packages, at worst, endangering their safety and exposing them to criminal prosecution.
A person who unknowingly takes a package from somebody in Anchorage and carries it to Dillingham, and it turns out that there are illegal drugs in there, it's going to be very difficult for investigators to know whether they knowingly carried it or whether they innocently carried it, and we're going to have a real hard time determining whether they're an innocent Good Samaritan or part of the drug trafficking itself.
Ney says this trend can be curbed if the drug traffickers believe that travelers at the airport have become suspicious of carrying packages, and especially if they believe people are willing to call the police if they suspect drugs are being smuggled. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Gold Rush era ski goes on display in Fairbanks.
It's charming and it's amusing that people could actually get on such a ragged looking thing and go somewhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership positions across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Two oil and gas companies have big drilling plans for Cook Inlet this summer. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports.
Hilcorp has submitted a request to amend its operations plan for its projects in the Nanilchik unit onshore about 40 miles north of Homer. The amended plan calls for the drilling of up to 2 oil wells. Currently, Hilcorp is permitted to do gas drilling work at this site. The first would be a 12,000-foot exploratory well, with the possibility of a second if that first one proves successful. In its plan submitted to the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Hilcorp says it may need to expand the existing drilling pad to accommodate the new drill rig and will determine in the next month if gravel will have to come from nearby wetlands. For that, they would need a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. Hilcorp will construct a temporary truck loading facility to transport the oil from the 6 400-barrel storage tanks it will have on site, with 2 to 4 loads being transported daily. Another company, Aurora Gas LLC, has filed for permits to drill on the west side of Cook Inlet at Nikolai Creek, about 10 miles south of Tyonek. Aurora is another independent exploration and production company and has been in Cook Inlet since 2011. Their plans for Nikolai Creek include both new and old wells and updating infrastructure in the area, including 700 feet of new gravel road and a 60,000-square-foot well pad. Aurora also intends to build a gathering line to transport gas to the Cook Inlet Gas Gathering System pipeline for sales to Kenai or Anchorage. Representatives for both Hilcorp and Aurora did not immediately return phone calls for this story. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The City of Seward and a Western Alaska Community Development Quota, or CDQ, group are working on a plan for a new harbor in the South Central community that could shelter a Bering Sea fishing fleet. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the innovative plan is designed to keep more fishing-related income in Alaska and help revive Seward's seafood processing industry.
In his cramped office in downtown Seward, Ron Long, the city's assistant city manager, is showing me an enlarged map of Seward's harbors.
Here's the existing infrastructure here. So there's one central portion of the basin that would need to be dredged to accommodate the largest of the vessels in the proposed fleet.
Long says the new harbor is already built, and the idea to use it for the CDQ fleet came up a couple of years ago when Western Alaska's Coastal Villages Region Fund approached the city. CVRF is the largest of the CDQ groups, and it brings in an estimated 175 million pounds of groundfish and crab annually. Currently, the group's fleet docks in Seattle.
And they've managed to leverage those initial shares into majority or outright ownership interest in 20 large vessels, crabbers, catcher processors, trawlers, and over a quarter of $1 billion in assets that they would like to bring home to Alaska.
But the new harbor needs a jetty to protect the large vessels from wave action. Long says when the CDQ group looked at Seward,
we had almost all of the things that they needed except sufficient moorage capacity in all weathers at all times. And so that's what started the conversation about finding a way to complete that basin that's over on the east side of the bay.
Seward's year-round ice-free port and rail access to points north also makes the project attractive. CVRF's seafood general manager Nick Souza says the group initially was not sure Seward was the right place.
Not quite big enough and not quite what we were thinking. And then they reworked it a few times, and they came back with something that would work. It was pretty big. It would fit all of our fleet in there, the factory trawler, as well as the cod boats and the crab boats.
Souza says having the fleet close to corporate offices in Anchorage is another plus. It eliminates the 3.5-hour flight to Seattle. He says it won't be cheaper to keep the boats in Seward, but that's not a drawback. He also emphasizes more development has to be done regarding support services the fleet needs, and that could take time.
2 years, 10 years, the whole infrastructure needs to be built up, not just, boom, the harbor's here. You know, fuel vendors need to be able to fill up, you know, our ship, the factory trawler, actually probably takes as much fuel as the whole city of Seward does. So it's like, you know, things like that need to be addressed.
The CDQ Group already has five large vessels with long-term moorage contracts at the city's existing harbor. Seward is working slowly but doggedly toward getting the new harbor finished. The city received a $400,000 appropriation from the state in 2010 to do a feasibility study and concept design. An additional $10 million from last year's transportation bond was invested in the project as well. Long says there is a need to find other users that would balance out the seasonal nature of the fishing fleet. The plan is to lease city-owned adjacent uplands to private developers and entrepreneurs and to attract more vessels to the new harbor.
We've had some recent activity over the last year or so with some of the oil and gas exploration and support fleet that's been being deployed to the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, and we expect that to continue. As more companies are interested, more lease acres are opened up. We also have had some renewed interest from existing customers, from tug and barge companies.
The city is now waiting to see if the $10 million in this year's capital budget survives the governor's veto. That money will allow Seward to begin constructing the breakwater this fall. With cruise ship landings down, Seward is looking to boost city revenues. In time, an uptick in marine support and fish processing could fill the gap. But CVRF says the project is bound to benefit the whole state by helping to Alaskanize the Bering Sea fisheries. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Sitka Community Hospital delivers babies, but that hasn't always been the case. For about 2 years, from 2009 to 2011, a lack of properly qualified physicians shut down its obstetrics program. KCAW's Ann Bryce looks at how the return of obstetrics has made a difference for expectant moms.
Letting go of that whole idea that birth is a scary thing.
I'm at a birth class at Sitka Community Hospital.
Women have been giving birth for thousands and thousands of years, and your body knows how to do this.
It's a five-session series, and this week, first-time moms are learning about natural childbirth techniques.
For me, it was all about prenatal care and eating the right foods and doing yoga and clearing all that baggage.
About nine women are lying on their sides with pillows wedged between their knees and with dad sitting close by. Brooke Chartier is due in just a few weeks. She's 23 years old and comes from a family of five kids.
I had always said I'd want to have five, and I got a Honda Pilot so I could fit all my kids in there. But after kind of being at the end of this pregnancy, I'm like, I'm just going to see how one goes. And then
she says since this is her first pregnancy, she had no idea what to expect.
People always say, well, you know, pregnancy is not like you see it on the movies and whatever. And then going through it, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I don't look like my same self with just a belly. Like, everything changes, not just your belly. And that's, even though I thought I knew what it was going to be like, you don't really know until you're in it, I guess.
Dr. Deborah Pullman provides Chartier's obstetrics care. She worked at Sitka Community Hospital in the early 90s and just recently came back to work as a family doctor delivering babies in 2011. She says caring for pregnant women is a privilege and brings her a lot of joy.
Most of medicine is dealing with people who are in pain, they don't feel well, something's gone wrong. Obstetrics is a natural process that thankfully only a small percentage ends up being problematic. And the rest is a natural process where families invite you to be part of this miraculous thing called birth, and it's very invigorating.
And they're super good at Sitka Community because they say, you know, if you feel nervous at all, call us. We'd rather have you come in, you know, 1,000 times or 100 times with nothing wrong, you know, than not call us and have something really be wrong. So they don't make you feel silly.
Sitka Community Hospital hasn't always had a strong obstetrics program. In fact, starting in 2009, the unit had to shut down completely because the only surgeon who could perform cesarean sections left the hospital. Without an OB program at Sitka Community, pregnant women either went to search or had to leave town for medical appointments and to give birth, putting total trust into doctors with whom they had no real relationship. There were a few midwives who did home deliveries, but they weren't trained in giving emergency C-sections. When CEO Hugh Hallgren arrived at the hospital a little over 3 years ago, it still didn't have OB services. So right away, at the suggestion of the board, he set out to rebuild the program.
So you get the physician first, and then we needed the physician in order to guide us in the process. Physicians are not all the same. They have their strengths and they have their preferences.
Word of Sitka Community's struggles even reached Deborah Pullman in Anchorage, where she was teaching medical students and residents.
So it kind of weighed heavily when it kept getting called and people were saying, our OB program is closed and we'd really like to reopen it. And I wasn't seeing anybody follow in my past footsteps. So I thought, well, you know, might as well do it.
Now there are two full-time family practitioners at Sitka Community Hospital who deliver babies. There are two other OB doctors, one who serves as a backup, and another who makes regular visits to look at more complicated obstetrical cases. Pullman sees roughly 6 to 12 patients a day. She says that even though rural physicians often work longer hours and get paid less, the relationship she has with patients and the high quality of her life makes it more than worth it.
You know, I don't want to be seeing 40 to 50 patients a day, running them through, you know, literally talking 5 minutes at a time so that I can get a big salary. And then when I get my time off, then I can forget that I'm a physician and do all those things where here in Sitka, you can go fishing in the summer if you get up early and you're not on call before you come to work.
The attention makes a difference for these soon-to-be moms.
I promise.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
The Tlingit-Haida Central Council holds its 78th annual Tribal Assembly in Juneau this week. Delegates from around Southeast and a few other areas will hear reports from Sea Alaska Corporation, the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood, and other organizations. Council President Ed Thomas says this year's theme is Hold Each Other Up.
We find that so often we spend a lot of time focusing on the negative, and so we want to ask people to work together, lift each other up, and try to have a positive way forward.
Delegates also will discuss and vote on resolutions addressing a variety of issues. They include elder housing, native language instruction, the Sitka Sound sacro fishery, and sea otter harvests. Delegates will meet through Saturday in downtown Juneau. A Metlakatla woman is gearing up for the upcoming Miss Indian World competition next week during the annual Gathering of Nations in Albuquerque, New Mexico. KRBD's Layla Carey has the story.
Rebecca Gew heard about the annual Miss Indian World cultural pageant through some other women in her hometown of Metlakatla. They wanted to sponsor a contestant and ask Gew whether she would participate.
I met the credentials that they needed, so they told me to think about it, and I agreed, and it's been an interesting journey so far.
Hugh has been busy preparing for the different segments of the competition, which include some of the expected elements of a pageant, talent, interview, etc. The cultural focus is what makes this competition unique. In addition to practicing her talent, Gyu has been brushing up on Tsimshian traditions. And her talent is traditional song and dance, something she's luckily had a lot of experience with already.
I am a part of two different dance groups. I've danced with three. I am part of the Killer Whale Dancers out of Metlakatla and the Lipkunam Gamalgit Gagotam Dancers from Anchorage.
In addition to her own dance performance, Gyu and other competitors will dance during the Gathering of Nations powwow, and the crowning will take place on the last day of the gathering. Wearing traditional clothing is part of the competition. Gyu says she prepared parts of her own regalia, but some was given to her by family members.
My button robe, my uncle made for me, and I've been adding to it. And I've made an apron, and my other uncle, Robert Houston, he is putting a design on it for me. And my uncle Walter Houston, he's making me jewelry. So I have a lot of things just from my uncles.
Gyu says her goal is to be a role model for Indigenous women and be a good representative for Alaska Natives and the Tsimshian people.
I'm proud to be an Alaska Native American, and I hope to promote pride in Indigenous women, pride in themselves, their tribe, and their community.
One experience Gyu looks forward to is meeting other Native Americans and learning about their traditions, too.
You know, it's like a big sisterhood, and they become friends, and I'm looking forward to finding friends that I will have for the rest of my life.
The Miss Indian World Cultural Pageant is April 25th through April 27th in Albuquerque. The annual competition started in 1984. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
An antique ski has been donated to the Fairbanks North Star Bureau for display at the Birch Hill Recreation Area. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the ski is thought to be a Gold Rush era relic.
Retired University of Alaska Fairbanks art professor Glenn Simpson says he found the hand-hewn wooden ski in the early 1970s on a hike to an historic mining site north of Fairbanks.
It's in an area called Vault, which was a gold mining area near the Chattanooga, up against the hills. I walked in there in the spring when the ground was frozen before the leaves came up, and I found this old ski back in there. Carried it out. It was such a funky ski, I had to have it.
Simpson says the grayed and warped ski was leaning on a tree amongst tailings piles and deteriorating cabins. The 8-foot-long ski has a nailed-on canvas strap binding, and Simpson suspects it dates back to the gold rush.
Somebody plaster mining out there who roughed out some skis so they could get to town or whatever. It's charming, and it's amusing that people could actually get on such a ragged-looking thing and go somewhere.
Simpson says he kept the ski at home for a few years, then gave it to the late Clem Rawert, who displayed it at his downtown Fairbanks outdoor shop until it closed in 1995. Rawert gave the ski back to Simpson before he died last fall. Simpson says he wants the historic ski to be where people can see it again.
I gave it to the Birch Hill Ski Center out there. I thought about the museum, but it's nice to have it where people are actually skiing. Apparently they're going to put up a few old skis as displays, and so it'll be there.
Simpson says he's asked that the ski display at Birch Hill include mention of Clem Rawert, an avid skier who treasured the old board that long decorated his shop. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer in Seward, Ann Bryce in Sitka, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.